So, joining us now, we have a very special call-in guest. He is a senior writer for Newsweek, MSNBC contributor, contributing editor to Vanity Fair, and New York Times bestselling author. You already know who it is. The king of always having a normal one online, Kurt Eichenwald. Kurt, how's it going?
Okay. Well, first, I want to correct you there. This is already started. Okay, this has already started. You've already started in with these right-wing narratives about who I am and what I do. First of all, I am a senior contributor to Vanity Fair. I am a senior writer at Newsweek, and I am a contributing contributor at MSNBC and a New York Times best-selling author. So you can correct that record right there, and then we can proceed. These tricks aren't going to work, okay?
So, Kurt, you're having another really good week online. Like I said, staying normal, staying regular all the time online. Could you just fill us in a little bit? What's going on with these emails you're sending Ben Shapiro about the Parkland teens?
Okay, I want to clear the record first of all. I didn't send any emails. Emails were sent by me in order to correct a vicious right-wing smear campaign from the Parkland High School victim, acting in concert with other right-wing actors. And I want to make something very, very clear to you. This was a routine day-long Twitter fight that I got in. This is one of my routine, if you've heard of a routine traffic stop, this is a routine day-long 48-hour Twitter fight. Nothing out of the ordinary. What happened was that Ben Shapiro and some of these Parkland students, underage students from Parkland, decided to team up and accuse me of being a fan of tentacle porn. I assure you, I've only ever researched tentacle porn in order to expose tentacle porn.
You were exposing it to your family in this case, right, Kurt?
Now I see you're trying to trick me. I know what's happening. That's pretty clever there. You're trying to trick me into saying I exposed myself to my family with tentacle porn. That's far from the truth. Everything was consensual and I have affidavits to prove this. And if you're going to keep lying, I want to make something very clear. This entire podcast is being recorded in real time by a court reporter in Dallas for a grand jury that has been convened to issue subpoenas and indictments related to my Twitter fight. I am very serious about this.
No, you take online very seriously, Kurt, and you know we respect that. I just want to get to the issue here. People have been making fun of you because of this hentai tentacle porn issue for a while now, and we just want to get to the bottom of it.
Let's be something very clear. Like millions of Americans, like about 75 million Americans, I have ironically dabbled in hentai tentacle porn, and this is a well-known fact. Will, this is a well-known fact, if you will. All you need to do is log on to any number of mainstream ironic tentacle porn websites. I'm a moderator myself on a number of them. Of course, I am a moderator on Captain Nemo versus the Hentai. I am the only moderator, of course, on Calamari Hot Mommy. .org. This is normal. These are job holding community members who engage in this sort of ironic family time. I'm in on the joke. I have engaged to the point of completion with tentacle porn in order to debunk tentacle porn. This is very simple. Millions of America have engaged in this ironic pastime. And if you disagree, if I detect laughter that is directed at me instead of with me in this matter, you will be hearing from the grand jury that has been convened.
Why do you think...
If you proceed with this line of questioning further, and if anyone listening to your podcast laughs at this, you too will receive a subpoena. I swear to God. I swear to the eight-tentacled God and I'm just getting noticed here on one of my burner phones used primarily for Twitter fights. I'm getting a notice here that I've been removed as a Vanity Fair contributing senior contributor editor. So we're going to, that's just wiping off of my list of credentials. So I'm no longer associated with Vanity Fair. That's no problem.
I've heard that the New York Times might actually revise downward your sales numbers and remove you from the list of best-selling authors there. Just a heads up.
Yes, I actually, this is a valid point. This is a valid point. Now this is, you're bringing it up from a place of mockery, which is going to get you, and which Chapo, I'm sorry, which Chapo?
This is, Matt.
Matt Chrisman, you've been served. I want to let you know that you've been served. You've officially been podcast served. You've been served for my audio grand jury. You will be going to prison, sir. However, yes, I am finding out we're finding out that not only have I been let go from Newsweek, fuck them, never needed them, fuck Newsweek. And we're also saying now MSNBC has let me go from 4 out of 5 of their letters, so I am now merely an S contributor.
Did you become a moderator on this site as part of your research for an article, or is this just more irony?
Just for a simple example, I want to just pull it up here for you. I'm going to Firefox. I'm just going to some of the open tabs that I just have, just some simple open tabs that any American writer might have on their Firefox browser on the laptop. Here's a simple, I'm just scrolling through my tabs. Bernie would have started Stalinist concentration camps. That's just something I'm working on. Bernie, screaming about Bernie, and it's a tentacle. Here, this is a good one. This is a perfect one. This is calamari hot mama, and I'm logged in. And I'm just going to bring up just the first page, just a simple first page, just to debunk this hentai phobia that you are trying to inflict on the ironic community. And I'm just going to put this very simple hentai. Oh, God. And there is some ironic stimulation. I've never been so stimulated in my life.
Ladies and gentlemen, former contributor to Vanity Fair, Newsweek, MSNBC, and former New York Times bestselling author, Kurt Eichenwald, everybody.
If I could just interrupt you, Will, this is Kurt's wife. I am now speaking to you from his podcast office. This is Kurt Eichenwald's wife. Anyone who has participated in this will be served with papers. The police have your last imprint, and we will be coming after you.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Mrs. Eichenwald. I hope Kurt's... And we are back. Thanks again to Kurt Eichenwald, master of being regular and normal online, for calling in and letting us know how normal he is.
That guy is only ever having a good one. It's amazing. He broke Richard Nixon's record for the most consecutive days having a very good day.
Always good to hear from movers and shakers in the media.
I'm actually laughing right now, Henry. I'm just coming back from the gym. There were Jews there. It was fine.
Something about Richard Nixon getting epilepsy by accident. I don't know.
If he'd ever heard of hentai, he would have loved it.
That's why he opened up China, is because the Japanese wouldn't show him hentai. He's like,
This is statecraft. Bob, they've got this thing over there. It's sex with tentacles. It's the goddamnedest thing I've ever seen. I've been fighting against these people my entire life. They won't just show me the tentacles.
So, moving on from one corner of the media to the other, I think events have pretty much lined up this week in such a perfect constellation that I think it would be a good idea to do sort of a deep dive into friend of the show and editor-in-chief of The Atlantic magazine, Jeffrey Goldberg.
Oh, hey, yes. Jeff.
Hey, Jeffrey.
Yes, the great helmsman of mainstream liberal thought.
Yeah.
You see in the West Coast, East Coast in general.
And you know what? This is going to be, you know, people will accuse this of being a negative segment, but I do want to say, Goldberg, he's an impressive guy. He went from being in the WWE to being the editor of the top magazine in orthodontist waiting rooms. So never let anyone tell you what you can and can't do. That's what I got to say.
Jeffrey had an amazingly busy week. A lot of ups and downs, a lot of ins and outs, Maud. But I want to begin with his interview with the new Saudi crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman.
Another friend of the show.
Yeah.
Now, you'll remember when we covered Thomas Friedman's sit-down throat job with the crown prince in the pages of the New York Times. I think Jeffrey Goldberg has topped, if you'll allow me to use that phrase, even Thomas Friedman and just how sloppy he can get to this beautiful new prince.
Our precious boy.
Goldberg and MBS, talk about big boy season. If only Kevin was there, that is... why they got Kevin fired is because they're like, no, too many big boys in one place.
We will get to this Kevin saga in a moment. Very epic.
I did see a picture of MBS in his jeans, and he is a large lad.
Oh,
really?
He's thick. He's like 6'5", and he's thick.
He rocks those size 50 Levi's, Kevin.
Yes. The other thing about that picture, it was probably the most disastrous part of the Saudi PR push, the MBS hairline reveal.
Not great.
Oh, my God.
Great.
But look, my hairline, it's receding a little bit. It's going to be fine. I'm doing natural holistic treatments. It's going to be back down to where it's supposed to be, right in the middle of my eyebrows. But Kevin D. Williamson, Mohammed bin Salman, which is the, Kevin D. Williamson is the anglicized version of Mohammed bin Salman. That's why I got it mixed up. His hairline looks like chicken wire. It's incredible. His hairline looks like you need to take a hacksaw to it and go over the top.
Felix, as you discovered, your hairline is currently just thin enough to not be able to do cornrows for comedy gags and spoofs.
Yeah, so, to all the people who say, like, oh, you'll never know what it's like to have, like, ALS or something. Actually, I do. I can't get cornrows because my hair is too thin now.
But this is why we're going to do a GoFundMe for hair plugs so that Felix can do cultural appropriation.
We weren't getting cornrows just to have me have cornrows. It was for a video about how it's cool to have cornrows.
Yeah.
But no, I want to get hair plugs that are permanently cornrows, just implanted in my skull.
Just stapled in there.
Yeah.
So the crown prince is doing his charm offensive of America right now. It's part of this huge PR push that, we've been talking about on this show for a while now, all the way back to when we talked about Saudi Vision 2030, this bold new plan to reform the kingdom and make it a little bit friendlier to its important allies in the West, namely America, or rather the American media, so they can stop covering the country like it's a, totalitarian theocracy that did 9/11.
Doing a genocide right now.
Yeah, and are also doing a genocide right now.
They put out an entire magazine in supermarket shelves across the country, right?
That was amazing.
That National Enquirer, I think, published it.
Yeah, it was $15. And somebody took a picture of it. I think it was in Nebraska or something. Can you imagine some fucking corn husker? He's got his Mountain Dew and his mega-sized Doritos, and he's waiting for the checkout.
Yeah, we know Trump country.
And he sees this picture. He sees this thing like, wow, this guy looks like he's really going to reform the Middle East. I better take a look.
I wish I could bet you money on how many Trump idiots bought it. I bet it's no less than 2,000 people.
Oh, yeah.
Because
2,000,
think about it.
Sounds about right.
Think about how many people shot their Keurigs or just did whatever idiotic thing, like went into Starbucks and said their name was the Constitution. they probably saw that and was like, oh, he's nice to Trump.
Yeah,
like
he's him. The guy who's going to get rid of all the terrorists because he put Trump's fat face on the side of a building.
I think what's important, though, in addition to doing a circular at every supermarket in America, the real goal here for MBS, the go-to guy is Jeffrey Goldberg. If you want a...
He's the plug.
He is the plug to like the, you know, one of the most prestigious flagships of the liberal media, and is also a committed partisan to the whatever the Israeli government does or thinks.
Yes.
So
dining partner.
So
the idea that
we now want to reform Saudi Arabia and its leaders is very important at a time in which the United States and particularly Israel have to toe the line on this rotten country, because we all have the same enemies in the Middle East, and Jeffrey Goldberg is perhaps one of the most reliable conduits for that particular line of thinking, be it from the American or Israeli intelligence communities. This is what this guy exists to do. It's why he's the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, which I think we'll get into later. So let's begin in this interview here. The headline is, Saudi Crown Prince, Iran's Supreme Leader Makes Hitler Look Good.
Damn.
You Make Hitler Look Good is the B-side to You Give Love a Bad Name. Wasn't as well received.
The interview begins. This much at least can be said for Mohammed bin Salman, the putatively reformist crown prince of Saudi Arabia. He has made all the right enemies. Among those who would celebrate his end are the leaders of ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, and Hamas.
Four-year-olds in Yemen dying of kwashior.
As well as Yemen's Houthi rebels.
And all the swollen
and
children.
And the entire clerical and military
Instagram
leadership.
Models who just want to be left alone.
And it says here, it goes on, he says, our conversation took place in Prince Khalid's living room beneath a painting depicting the 1945 meeting between President Franklin Roosevelt and King Abdul Aziz ibn Saud, the founder of modern Saudi Arabia.
I wish it was DJ Khalid.
Shout out to that reference to Adam Curtis in the film Bitter Lake, which takes its title from that very meeting in the Suez Canal between Roosevelt and the founder of the House of Saud.
The beginning of a beautiful relationship.
A beautiful relationship that has really blossomed into so many wonderful things in the modern world. The collaboration between the post-war United States Empire and fanatical, theocratic, oil-rich Saudi Arabia.
It's been awesome for everyone.
Lots of fun franchises all over the world. You've probably visited their locations in Afghanistan, the Caucasus region, anywhere. They have just, you know, they're like when a doctor gets really into franchising Subways.
Now, the interview begins where he, you know, tees up a nice, big, easy softball for MBS by saying, could you start by talking about Islam and the role you think it should play in the world? Ooh. And it gives him a chance to say, Islam is a religion of peace. Mm. And then go on to say, you know, our duty is to spread the word of God, but, you know, we also believe in freedom as well. But then he says, now today in the triangle of evil, and Goldberg says, the triangle of evil? And MBS says, yes, I will explain in a moment. In this triangle, they are trying to promote the idea that our duty as Muslims is to reestablish the caliphate, to reestablish the mindset of the caliphate, that the glory of Islam is in building an empire by force. But God didn't ask us to do this, and the Prophet Muhammad did not ask us to do this. So he's talking about caliphate mindset, and he wants to reassure all of the readers that, you know, Saudi Arabia and Islam, the modern version of it, does not seek to establish a caliphate by force.
Huh.
But Goldberg says, about the triangle, and MBS says, first in the triangle, we have the Iranian regime that wants to spread their extremist Shiite ideology. They believe if they spread it, the hidden imam will come back again, and he will rule the world from Iran and spread Islam even to America. So he's like, yeah, you know all the things that we're accused of doing? Actually, it's Iran that's doing it, and it's the Shiite extremism.
Oh.
And he's bringing up our good friend, the hidden imam. Everyone take a drink.
Yeah, because, you know, like the people who actually did try to establish a caliphate by force very recently, you guys might have remembered hearing about that. They really definitely were in favor of all of the Shia ideas. They were very Shia friendly.
Oh, they were worshiping fire, doing all the bad things that they do. No, I like that, you know, they're not Iran's goal is not any geopolitical aim. They just have to collect the Dragon Balls and get their one wish to bring Ayatollah Khomeini back.
So the first part of the triangle is Iran. The second part is the Muslim Brotherhood.
And the third part are the terrorists, which are Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and everyone who believes in caliphate mindset.
Wait a minute. I'm confused.
I think it will reveal itself as the interview goes on.
Like the Mahdi. It's like an advent calendar.
we got Syria. Oh, we got Yemen. Whoa, we got the biggest piece of chocolate. It's the Mahdi.
Now, Goldberg is, of course, a serious journalist. You know, yes. He's not going to use this opportunity to talk to this young prince, not press him on some hard, tough issues.
Crown Prince Salman, can Tekashi 6ix9ine say the N-word? I'm glad you asked, Jeffrey.
He says, isn't it true, though, that after 1979, but before 1979 as well, the more conservative factions in Saudi Arabia were taking oil money and using it to export a more intolerant extremist version of Islam, Wahhabist ideology, which could be understood as a kind of companion ideology to Muslim Brotherhood thinking? MBS responds, first of all, this Wahhabism, please define it for us. We're not familiar with it. We don't know about it.
Can you define the word, please? Can you use it in a sentence?
Goldberg says, what do you mean you don't know about it? MBS says, what is Wahhabism? And Goldberg says, you're the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. You know what Wahhabism is.
Damn.
MBS says, no one can define this Wahhabism. It's like neoliberalism.
Yes.
Yeah. It's just a slur that, you know, people use for, you know.
Well, that is an old line. That is an old line saying that Wahhabism is a slur and then it's not a real thing and then it's just normal Islam, which is pretty cool. I mean, if the guy who started my religion got kicked out of his village for stoning too many women to death, I'd probably be like, yeah, well, who's that bitch? I don't know her. when your main chick finds your second phone, when your main family finds your second secret family, and in Wahhabism, that second family doesn't have to be secret.
Are we talking about Wahhabism or Marco Rubio? Folks, Marco Rubio.
Allegedly.
So he presses him on Wahhabism, and MBS says, no one can define Wahhabism. There is no Wahhabism. We don't believe we have Wahhabism. We believe we have in
Saudi Arabia. Wait a minute. We don't have the thing that we don't know what it is?
Yeah. We don't know what it is, but we don't have it, okay. And we can't define it even if we did have it. We believe we have in Saudi Arabia Sunni and Shiite. We believe we have within Sunni Islam four schools of thought. And then he goes on to talk about those schools of thought and give a sort of filibuster, this long, meandering answer about all the different schools of thought in Sunni Islam.
Yeah, you've got Inche.
And then Goldberg asks, but what, you know, he's pressing him here. You know, this is real journalism.
Mr. Too Damn Journalist.
He says, what about the funding of extremists? MVS says, when you talk about funding before 1979, you were talking about the Cold War. You had communism spreading everywhere, threatening the United States and Europe and also us. Egypt had turned into that time into that sort of regime. We worked with whomever would get we could use to get rid of communism. Among those was the Muslim Brotherhood. We financed them in Saudi Arabia, and the United States of America financed them. True. Very true.
Wait, does he go on to say they stopped doing it after 79?
No, he says, well, in the Cold War they were doing it, and then after the Cold War...
But that's like when that's when it became its most coordinated. That's when they kicked it into its highest gears in 79. After the seizure of the Grand Mosque. After they were like, we can take all of our devout men and send them overseas into proxy wars and accomplish even more of our goals. Because we have more money now.
That was
holy shit.
That was the Cold War when we had to defeat communism. As IBS tells you, the America funded the Muslim Brotherhood too. This is making a lot of sense to me, and this is the first time anyone has been able to explain Middle Eastern politics to me. I'm sorry, Felix.
I was talking to those other girls when I didn't know you really liked me like that before 1979.
So they have a little back and forth about the funding of extremism, and Goldberg gets a chance to say this line. I spent a lot of time in Pakistan and Afghanistan in the late 1990s and early 2000s. Thanks, Jeff.
Wow. You take any interesting cab rides over there, Jeff? Please tell me about them.
Are you angling for an internship?
Yeah. I have a global perspective. Thank you, Jeff. My summer abroad was the most wonderful experience of my life.
So they go. They have a back and forth on this, and then Goldberg says, "You think you'll ever be friendly with Qatar again?" And MBS says, "It has to happen one day. We hope they learn fast. It depends on them." So here's where it gets really good. Goldberg says, and this is it gets to the heart of what Goldberg really believes in and wants to get out of this interview. He says, "You speak extraordinarily bluntly about Iran and its ideology. You've even equated the supreme leader to Hitler. What makes him a Hitler? Hitler is the worst thing you can be."
Oh, man, you don't want a Hitler, dude.
IBS says, I believe the Iranian supreme leader makes Hitler look good. Goldberg, really? Hitler didn't want to do what the supreme leader is trying to do. Hitler tried to conquer Europe. This is bad. Goldberg just says, yes, very bad. But think about that fucking follow-up.
But what does he say that...
that he says, Hitler tried to conquer Europe, but what Iran is trying to do is worse than that.
But what
very
does
bad.
He say that Iran is he trying to do that's
say,
worse than...
He doesn't say.
They want to make the caliphate.
Oh, no, he does
say.
Yeah.
In the
say.
Triangle. Remember the triangle theory.
Oh, right, right, right.
Yeah, that's why Phil you. Jackson is
yeah,
the
Iran
new
is
caliphate.
The triangle no, he does say. Goldberg says, yes, very bad. And MBS says, but the supreme leader is trying to conquer the world.
What?
He's trying to conquer the world.
He's doing a pretty shitty job of it.
He believes he owns the world. They are both evil guys. He is the Hitler of the Middle East. In the 1920s and 30s, no one saw Hitler as a danger. Only a few people, including his family, who received him warmly and had close relations with the Adolf Hitler.
They have heirlooms that Hitler gave them, or that they bought. But wait, so Khomeini's trying to take over the world?
Well, Khomeini's dead.
Khomeini, I'm sorry.
Khomeini. The supreme leader of Iran.
I just woke up.
They should have more than two letters differentiating their names.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's what makes him worse than Hitler.
Yeah.
Actually, that's how you know he was as bad as Hitler, because there was Hitler and Himmler, and they did that to confuse people. It was like rabbit season and duck season. Maybe Khomeini isn't really dead. Maybe I'm right about that Dragon Ball plot, that they're going to bring him back to life when they collect the Mahdi balls.
So Iran is trying to take over the world, and we have to stop them before they do, just like Hitler.
They're doing a very shitty job.
Yeah.
Yeah. They control, like, what, 0.5% of the world?
They have a military budget that's a fraction
also,
of
America's. It would be instructional to just look at a map of the nation of Iran and Persia over the last 1,000 years to see how many times it's expanded its border.
Yeah.
You know, they were really close to taking over the world during the Peloponnesian Wars.
Yep.
And then the first Wahhabis, the Spartans, stopped them.
Hell yeah. Okay, so he says here, we want to avoid war. And Goldberg says, is the problem in your mind religious? And IBS says, as I told you, the Shiites are living normally in Saudi Arabia. We have
no... Have it a normal one. Have it a normal one. I wake up, I make my tea, I get bulldozed and shot by internal security. Just have
we
it a
have
normal
no
one.
We have no problem with Shiites. Like he said, they're living very normally
in
Saudi
Stalin
Arabia.
Yeah, as Stalin said, no Shiites, no problem.
So he goes on, he filibusters again, very long answer on what Obama thought about Iran versus Trump. He basically says they both believe that Iran is a problem, but they had different approaches to it. So he avoids criticizing Obama. Goldberg then asks, speaking of painful decisions, are you making the situation in Yemen worse through military actions that are causing humanitarian catastrophes? There is a lot of justified criticism of your bombing campaigns. That is a really artfully worded question, and it does bring to mind the sort of phrasing that the New York Times or other outlets will use to describe what's currently happening in Gaza right now, where it's just sort of like, some critics might be saying that your war is something that they might consider genocidal. Or the New York Times, this is a real headline from today. Sporadic rifle fire from the Israeli side of the Gaza border made clear that the Palestinian protests could elicit the sort of response that killed 20 people a week ago. So going on, MBS's answer to this is, first of all, we have to go back to real evidence, real data. I'm not even going to read the rest of his answer.
MBS here. Just scrolling through screens, Minority Report style, and half those screens are just Instagram models, and he's throwing hearts and commenting like, I love you, you're so beautiful, come here. And then on the other side of the screen, just Google like how to pretend something doesn't exist.
Welcome MBS to the Vox.com masthead.
And so, yeah, he lets him skate on the idea that
he's murdering
that he's carrying
country.
Out a genocide in Yemen. And then, you know, there's not much more in this interview. He gets him to say that, you know, Israel has a right to exist and that Saudi Arabia has no problem with Jewish people either. And that prompted David Frum to say that MBS is now officially better on Judaism and Israel than Jeremy Corbyn is.
Right.
MBS is the head of the country where if you were Jewish, you're not allowed inside it. And if you practice the religion openly, you will be executed.
Well, he is right, though. I mean, this is a better friend to Israel than Jeremy Corbyn.
That's true.
That's the thing. That's all that matters. When people, when Fromm and Goldberg talk about being good, they're not talking about being good for Jews. They're not talking about creating an environment where Jews are open in a society. They're talking about supporting Israel. That's all that matters. Because the whole goal for all of these motherfuckers is to get all the Jews into Israel eventually and turn it into just a steroidal nuclear powerhouse down there.
Every single Jew in Israel for a huge party.
Yeah, that's the idea.
Well, you know, when two big boys get together, you get a great big belly full of truth.
Well, here's what I don't get. So MBS has all this money to spend on, you know, propaganda, but they still sell the tabloid. They don't just give it away. They sell it.
Because they're in America. Nothing, if something's free, it's worthless. That is what we know. Now, and they understand that much about us to know that.
How many flyers have you been given in your life?
Like, thousands.
Yeah. What have you followed up on? Probably the flyer we were giving out to get a new host for the show.
I've got a filing cabinet full of them, and one of these days, when I get some free time, I'm going to go through
now,
them.
Imagine
they're like the Spartacists. They're just hanging out around convention centers, selling the MBS, or just handing out the MBS issue of National.
It's glossy and there's fun. Yeah, there's trivia in it. There's gossip.
That's why it's worth money.
A crossword puzzle.
Okay. Before we get into more Jeffo, there has been this, you know, multi-month long push where MBS will talk to whatever shitty liberal journalist, whether it's Goldberg or Friedman, et cetera, et cetera. But the one thing he got that is worth more than 1,000 of those combined is the Rock cosign.
Yep.
He got co-signed by Dwayne the Rock Johnson. Dwayne All Rock Johnson, as he is now called.
Yep.
That's a very Bill Maher joke. Please put it in the real time.
Well, how about this? Why doesn't he just buy The Atlantic or any of these other publications? They have more than enough money to do it.
Remember when people told us we should run a news site? No one wants to get into that business.
Now, you say for this propaganda effort, you know, it makes sense that they would sell this $15 glossy magazine. As counterpoint to that, I will direct your gentlemen to the book that I have displayed on my bookshelf, Xi Jinping, The Governance of China, a book that includes many glossy photographs and a fairly high production value.
High quality.
Given out for free by the government of China.
Can you believe how benevolent he is?
Well, yeah.
So, I don't know. Who's doing better? President Xi? Maybe,
President Xi.
Maybe the greatest world leader of our time?
Or closer to conquering the entire world
than Iran or Saudi Arabia.
And also, you know what? Unlike Saudi Arabia, Iran deserves to conquer the world.
That interview with MBS, that was a good kickoff to Jeffrey's week, but it wasn't even him just letting this asshole say Iran wants to conquer the world with absolutely no pushback whatsoever. Not even close to being the most embarrassing thing that happened to Jeffrey Goldberg this week. The most embarrassing thing, for sure, was the hilarious implosion of the Kevin D. Williamson saga and his unceremonious canning from The Atlantic almost as soon as that fucking Minge the Merciless, as we've been calling him,
that's not a
hired.
Fucking mispronunciation, people.
We're
it's
saying
a joke.
That his mouth, it looks like a hairy pussy. It's a very smart joke. You need a high IQ to understand it. Jesus Christ.
So Jeffrey's role in the Kevin D. Williamson saga is underrated because people have been largely focusing on Cold Stone Steve Austin, the fat people's eyebrow,
the El Nino of big boy season.
Yeah, they've been focusing on Kevin and
also the intolerant libs
and the intolerant libs and whether Kevin's a martyr or not. But really,
absolutely,
the real player here is Jeffrey Goldberg, who made the decision to hire him to, you know, be a contributor to their new ideas section.
Whoa.
And when the controversy first started coming out, particularly Kevin's comments regarding that, you know, women who have gotten abortions deserve to be hanged, Jeffrey's response to that was, in effect, "I don't agree with Kevin, but it's a tweet. Come on, people. It's a tweet. We shouldn't judge people based on, like, you know, a throwaway comment or whatever." This was the same argument that Brett Stevens made. And Jeffrey was implying that, you know, again, liberals are being too precious. It's important to hear other ideas, even if you disagree with them. And basically said that Kevin was talented, but he was just trolling. He was taking a needlessly provocative position in an attempt to sort of
own the libs
and stir intellectual debate.
Well, mostly own the libs.
Yeah. Then it came out that Kevin Williamson had indeed said the exact same thing on a podcast. That was a bridge too far. And in Jeffrey's response to it, he seemed to say that, you know, a tweet is one thing, but him saying the exact same thing in an audio version is too much. And he said here, he did not want to judge people for their worst tweets or assertions in isolation. But then on Thursday, Mr. Goldberg wrote in a memo to his staff that he had come to see the writer's remarks on Twitter as something more than merely trollish. The editor cited a podcast episode from the same month in which Mr. Williamson elaborated on his anti-abortion views. The tweet was not merely an impulsive, decontextualized, heat-of-the-moment post, as Kevin had explained it, Mr. Goldberg wrote. Furthermore, the language used in the podcast
what
was callous
moment?
And violent.
What heat?
This runs contrary to the Atlantic's tradition of respectful, well-reasoned debate and to the values of our workplace.
Just because he was sweating when he tweeted it doesn't mean there was any heat in the moment.
A quick aside here.
Treat of the moment.
I'm reading from the New York Times coverage of this, but it has this little nugget here that is just too good to pass up. The podcast in question was a National Review show called Mad Dogs and Englishmen, hosted by Mr. Williamson and Charles C.W. Cook.
Oh, God.
The title of that podcast is more offensive to me than Kevin comments on capital punishment for women.
Oh, my God. That would be the name of a morning zoo crew show in the Raj if it still existed.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's what... Oh, God. That's what Opie and Anthony would be called in Victorian England.
Yes.
It's just very upsetting. Oh, God.
What's hilarious about this,
there's probably like a whiskey review corner or something. Oh, God. We have
No, gin.
This.
It's English.
Oh, yeah, it's gin.
Oh,
yeah,
God.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, they drink gin. They're probably smoking really shitty cigars while doing it.
Oh. I'm giving myself lupus just thinking about
this.
Yeah,
if you actually listen to that podcast, you find a more controversial opinion from Kevin. He walks back hanging the women. And he says they should actually tie them to train tracks, more in line with his preferred method of doing things.
But what's funny about this is it reveals Jeffrey Goldberg is an absolute fraud. Because his whole thing in trying to hire Kevin in the first place is like, he's provocative. You know, we're a liberal magazine, but we're not afraid to challenge ourselves and have ideas from outside the bubble. And then when confronted with Kevin's actual beliefs... His defense immediately is he's just joking.
Yeah.
He doesn't really believe that.
Yeah.
And then he has to walk it back when it becomes obvious that, yes, indeed, he does believe it. So
yeah, it's
a lot of fucking respect that someone like Jeffrey Goldberg has for conservative ideas.
Well, that's just it. It's that the thing that needs to be gotten away with completely is the idea that there are any ideas being discussed or exchanged in any of these things. On the New York Times op-ed page, at The Atlantic... There are no ideas being transmitted. No one is learning anything. You are intentionally riling up an audience for response. It is just the clickbait model of online publication brought to the mainstream. That's all that it is. It is totally vacuous, and that's all that it exists to do.
That's true, but like the other important thing about, particularly about what the Kevin saga tells us about the current state of the liberal media, is that they are at a crisis point in their...
A crisis point in the media.
In their sort of self-image and conception, because The Atlantic is a magazine owned by David Bradley, who is a committed ideological neoconservative, but sold and pitched to an audience entirely of cosmopolitan liberals. New York Times has sort of a similar dynamic going with it. The thing is, what they are selling to their readership is the fantasy that they are smarter and more open-minded than the baying, idiotic hordes that are beneath them, the Trump voters. This is
And that's the thing.
This is why there's the most important qualification for Kevin Williamson or Bret Stephens or any of these guys is that they're against Trump.
Yep.
Here's the problem. These people have their only influence now is with liberals.
Mm-hmm.
The conservative movement, an actual body politic, has completely passed them by. There is no such thing as a, you know, anti-Trump conservative now.
Not on the ground. No.
Not with any actual influence over government or policy.
Every single anti-Trump conservative has a column somewhere.
Exactly. There are probably, this is not an exaggeration. This is my best guess. I would say between 500 and 1,000 people in America who think Trump is bad, but the Iraq war was good. So, like, all these people have columns, and their only influence is with their a liberal readership. However, the one line, the abortion technically still is the red line, because libs can identify, you know, they're happy to entertain, you know, thoughts of foreign intervention or cutting Social Security or free markets. However, things like wanting to hang women for getting an abortion, or just the outright criminalization or demonization of abortion, is still something that most people who read The Atlantic rightly want nothing to do with. Not even nothing to do with, but like they don't think rightly that it's an idea or a thought that should be given serious treatment.
Well, it's the only
in a
thing
magazine
that, makes,
that
the
they're
only
paying
thing that makes
for.
Them liberal is that they're pro-choice.
Exactly.
So they're going to their core in a way that all this other contrarianism doesn't.
Exactly. And here's the thing, though, is like there's no more need for people like Kevin D. Williamson outside of these sort of, you know, hothouses like the National Review or things that are pitched solely to ideological conservatives of a certain variety, right?
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck use does it have for the New York Times or the Atlantic to hire these people? Just to goose their liberal readership into considering whether maybe we should criminalize abortion? These people have no they have no influence over policy or the conservative movement anymore. So what is their value add to a place like The Atlantic or The New York Times?
It's to flatter the audience. It's to make them feel like, yes, that they're more broad-minded than either the hooting swine who voted for Trump or the Antifa hordes of illiberal leftists. But the thing is, they still have lines, you know? They still have things that are unacceptable. There have to be, because if you don't have anything, then what the fuck are you? You have to have some sort of container. And so there has to be a line, a thing that's beyond the pale. And yeah, he fucking went across it. Be in his zeal for triggering libs. Congratulations, you triggered the libs. And they don't want to hire you now because you did it. You were too good at triggering the libs. So go back to the National Review.
This dynamic about conservative intellectuals, I just want to read a little bit from a post by Henry Farrell from this week that I think really does a very good job summarizing this. It's titled, "Who Has Any Use for Conservative Intellectuals?" And I just want to read from a little bit. He says, "The conservative movement perceived the need for intellectuals, both to hold their own fractious coalition together through fusionism and the like, and to justify their goals to liberals who dominated the space of serious policy discussions and could possibly stop them. Liberal policy types, for their part, needed to understand that what was happening among conservatives and perhaps hopes to influence it a little. The result was that the conservative intellectuals were in a highly advantageous structural position, serving as the primary link between two different spheres which didn't otherwise come much into contact. As Network Sociology 101 will tell you, this allowed them a fair amount of arbitrage and enough slack that people like Jonah Goldberg were treated as serious thinkers."
Oh, God, remember that.
The problem is, and now he's saying, like, the Never Trump people, remember they defected en masse, thinking that it was a fairly cheap gesture of independence. We all remember the Never Trump issue of the National Review.
Yeah, they were born defective and they never stopped.
"Not only did this damage these intellectuals' personal ties with the new administration and the conservative movement, but it opened up the way for a conservatism that basically didn't give a fuck about policy ideas and the need to seem serious anymore. The result is that conservative intellectuals don't have all that much influence over conservatism anymore. The problem is that without such influence over conservatives, these intellectuals' capital with liberals and the left is rapidly diminishing too. If conservative intellectuals don't have much of an audience without conservatism itself, why should people on the opposite side listen to them anymore? Their actual ideas are mostly not that strong. Some of them are good writers, but good writing only goes so far. The only plausible case for paying attention to conservative intellectuals, qua conservative intellectuals, is that perhaps the pendulum will swing back after Trump and the old regime will be restored. That might happen, but you wouldn't want to be betting serious money on it." And I think that gets it exactly right about this sort of panic that assholes, like everyone who has invested so heavily in the idea that it's really important to engage with the thoughts of the other side, are at a point now where they really can't continue this charade for much longer.
Yeah.
Because conservatives never ever pretend to take seriously the ideas of,
oh, of course
liberals
not.
Or the left.
And if you're gonna,
nor would they ever, ever even conceive of hiring like a left-wing voice to write for the National Review or Weekly Standard.
Yeah, and if you're going to pretend to care about the other side's ideas, then the other side loves Trump. Get some actual pro-Trump fucking conservatives then.
Get Bill Mitchell. Those on are the a one people.
There's zero pro-Trump columnists at a major mainstream like liberal audience thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you only have these ideological eunuchs who have no influence and speak for no one.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're really interested in representing the country, get one of those freakish positive Trump reply guys. Get one of those children.
Get
one of those kids who can't seem to wash their face or wear shirts that fit and just reply like MLK would have loved Trump and stuff like that. Just put them in there. No one cares. It's going to represent way more people than, Snidely Whiplash or Homer Simpson in the landlord costume or any of the other people you're hiring.
But I think it should be noted that both David Bradley and Jeffrey Goldberg are ideologically committed neoconservatives, right? Which means they're happy to fucking deal with social liberals and they don't mind it at all.
Yeah, they don't care about
it. They don't
give
a shit about it. That politics doesn't interest them. In fact, all domestic politics are entirely negotiable to them. It could shake out any way, they'd be fine.
As Richard Nixon referred to it, it's building outhouses in Peoria. Who gives a shit?
That's domestic politics to them. Jeffrey Goldberg has even said as much during the 2008 election. He said, the only question in this election is what the president will do to prevent Al-Qaeda from getting nuclear weapons. Oh. Everything else, taxes, education, infrastructure, that's all just window dressing. It's the only question worth addressing. And then, of course, unspoken in that is how to confront Iran militarily as well.
Well, I object to one point, though, when you say that Kevin Williamson was just triggering the libs with his outrageous abortion remarks about his Day of the Rope fantasy for women. That's not the case. This is a very personal matter to him.
Oh, yes. Let's talk about this.
So the friend of the show, the Baseball Crank, has been one of Kevin Williamson's most indefatigable defenders recently and correctly points out that, conservatives have been hearing for years from the left that, you men should not have a say over women's body. This is a women's issue. That's what abortion is. Apparently, that's not the case. This is a major issue that impacts Kevin. Reading from the Crank.
Do the voice.
Kevin feels...
Do the voice!
Kevin feels especially strongly... Oh, sorry.
Yeah. No, he's not sick. He can do the voice.
I'm a little sick, but... This is precisely why this is asymmetrical. Kevin feels especially strongly about this issue because he's the sort of person who could, maybe would, have been aborted after 1973. They extend no similar empathy to how this affects him personally. And then links to Kevin Williamson's big article about the issue, which I'll read from right now in the National Review. This is from 2015, about that 20-week abortion bill. A note to House Republicans. This is the 42nd anniversary of Roe v. Wade. I never need reminding of which anniversary it is. It's always the same as my age. I was one of those who entered the world through a pregnancy of the sort we call unplanned. Though I do not object to being, quote, the result of human action, but not the execution of any human design. I was born about 3 months, call it a trimester, before Roe. In my case, the result was an adoption. Mine wasn't, as it turns out, the sort of success story you'd put in a brochure. My adoptive parents were divorced only a few years later, and there was subsequently a great deal of unpleasantness in my home upon which I do not intend to dwell. Some had happier families, some far worse. Eventually, I discovered that I had certain talents, which friends encouraged and teachers helped me develop. I had to be...
I could float upside down. It was invisible in mirrors.
I had the uniquely American experience of playing high school football in West Texas for what was the longest losing...
Friday Daywalker lights.
More like...
Friday Night Frights.
Learned a trade at the mighty, mighty Daily Texan at the University of Texas, and then moved to India to apply it. I was editor-in-chief of a small newspaper before I was 30, and started a daily newspaper in Philadelphia a few years later. I failed at that, but it was tremendously fun. And on our better days, we put out a more interesting broadsheet than The Inquirer. I've published a few books, had a few rejected, walked in the foothills of the Himalayas, and driven a convertible through the Alps, gotten into bar fights, played Box Prelude as part of a classical guitar duet. I work at the only magazine I've ever really wanted to work at, and Bill Buckley once asked me for a word he was unable to call up at the moment. There have been a few rough stretches and some that have been nearly perfect. None of it was optional.
I've been a puppet, a pauper, a poet, a king.
Is it possible to give somebody like a 500th trimester mercy abortion? That is the most depressing thing I have ever heard.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, you want to abort me? Guess what? Bill Buckley placed his lizard hand on my shoulder. I got my book rejected. I've been in bar fights. I've had a little drink called tequila.
I've driven a car.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I could go to the movies by myself like that.
I climb the gentle foothills of the Himalayas.
Yeah, like if you get off of the airport, off the airplane in Kathmandu, congratulations, you're in the foothills of the Himalayas.
I've gotten into a hot tub without my t-shirt on.
I think if you're a pro... life position is you need to ban abortion or else Kevin Williamson will be aborted, you're fucking up. Because he's not really a sterling example of the people that you want to have around.
This is great. I love that he takes it personally because he could have been aborted. Because it's like the guys who are like, yeah, dude, don't insult the military. I actually almost signed up for the National Guard after 9/11. That could have been me.
They act like he fucking crawled out of a dumpster behind a Planned Parenthood after they like scraped him out.
Listen to this. Here's the climax of the article. People like me, we unplanned, the millions of us, now live the first part of our lives outside the protection of the laws of these United States. He's comparing himself to Dred Scott. Our lives, and very often our deaths, are instruments of the convenience of others. That was different in my case by a matter of a few months. It is impossible for me to know whether the woman who gave birth to me would have chosen abortion if there had been a more readily available alternative in 1972. I would not bet my life, neither the good nor bad parts of it, on her not choosing it.
Well, Virgil, as you rightly pointed out, we're in a weird place now where genetic screening is able to tell earlier and earlier if your fetus will become a National Review columnist. And we're in danger of losing them, all of them.
Ma'am, your child will be perfectly round.
two things.
Ma'am, two things. Your child is already trapped in the uterine elevator.
Ma'am, your child will never be able to ride the New York City subway.
Two things. One, he could have been aborted before Roe.
Yeah.
The idea that there were no abortions before Roe, you're a fucking idiot if you think that. People were having plenty of abortions. They were just unsafe and often dangerous for the mothers.
They would actually throw the baseball crank at them. That's why he's so against it.
And two, anybody could have been a fucking abortion. This idea that only unwanted pregnant or only poor women or only people who go on to adopt their kids might have been. Plenty of people... plenty of women have abortions who are married, who have children already. It's a choice that 30% by some estimations of American women have made. Any of us could have been fucking aborted. The idea that he's some fucking special case.
Wait. Are
that
you
he's
saying,
some escapee from Logan's Run.
Are you saying we're also in the protected class of
we
possible
are.
Abortion?
Guys,
oh my God.
We are, everyone in this room, we're all survivors.
Any women listening right now, I just found out I survived a near-death experience as a child.
Don't want to feel
alone. Please protect me.
I
help send nudes.
I actually would like to talk about this from a slightly personal perspective. Matt, you mentioned, does the pro-life movement know favors to have Kevin Williamson as their... either as their spokesperson saying the thing that they all actually must never, ever actually say, which is that if abortion becomes criminalized, women will be punished with
the force of law.
If not executed, certainly put in jail, as is the case in every other country where abortion is illegal. Like El Salvador, there are women in jail for having miscarriages and shit like that. Of course.
Well, in Indiana too.
Yep.
We've done that here. It's just not on the law. It's just not on the laws in that way, but we do that here.
But also the idea that like had I been aborted, I, Kevin Williamson, wouldn't be here sharing my brilliant thoughts and writing with you is perhaps not the best sales pitch either. Kevin makes the point, and his defenders have done this, as Virgil pointed out. They're getting into this big debate that, like, this is personal for Kevin because, you know, he missed the cutoff by about a week. You know, now he's out for justice. He's out for justice. Okay. The pro-life movement would do better to not use Kevin as their spokesperson, but me. Because I actually come from the exact same circumstances as Kevin. I was born to a teen mom and adopted very shortly thereafter. No, I don't. I'm not saying I would prefer to be dead. Now that I have my life, I'm glad I have it. I very well could have been aborted.
But
however,
wait, I'm confused though. You were born after Roe, though.
Yeah,
but that's not that. He's assuming he would have been aborted.
Oh no. Will
so why weren't you aborted?
Will loopered himself.
Yeah. It's actually a time paradox on my own father. Yeah.
And I was actually Will's biological parents. I also loopered. I went back and I was like, keep going. You're doing great, dog. Conceive this kid. I need this.
Well, hang on. If Matt's right and anyone is a survivor of abortion, then I think we should go bigger. I think it should be Tom Hanks. And they should put these big billboards up that say, hey, America, Tom Hanks could have been aborted.
Hey, you like all his movies? Now imagine they don't exist. But, I mean, like, for me, like, personally, like, I acknowledge, like, I believe abortion should be legal. I don't think it's a... I think it's a moral decision that every woman has to decide for themselves. I don't know where I would come down personally on the issue if I was ever involved in a pregnancy. However...
If you ever have sex, we'll find out.
We'll find out, hopefully. Knock on wood. However, the thing
we've been trying for years, you and me.
The line between existing and not existing from the moment of conception is something that could be said about everyone. And I'm sorry, like, if my life just blinked out of existence at the hand of a doctor or a unwanted pregnancy, well, then I can't say that not existing really bothered me before then.
I'm with Kierkegaard. Or no, I'm sorry. I'm with Schopenhauer. I think it would have been better if none of us had ever been born.
Well, like I said, now that I'm here, it's pretty good. And
For now.
But again, this cheap maudlin sympathy act that Kevin D. Williamson is going for by being like, I could have been aborted, is the cheapest fraud imaginable. And people are calling him brave for saying it. And it's just like, yeah, I love the idea that now he's wreaking his vengeance on the women of the world. But now another line that his defenders have taken up in this... his grotesque idea, as Virgil said, his day of the rope fantasies about all the harlots out there that would have killed him if he had the chance. His defenders are saying, oh, well, you didn't listen to the full interview. He goes on to say, I'm sort of squishy on capital punishment as an idea. He sort of waffles on whether he's even in favor of the death penalty.
Oh, he loves waffles.
He waffles and he pancakes and he omelets and he donuts.
He says he's not sure if he favors capital punishment, but if we do have capital punishment, it should be hangings and beheadings rather than lethal injection.
To make it as spectacular as possible.
Yeah, he wants to see the old style capital punishment. And then he also said that he doesn't believe laws can be applied retroactively. So his defenders are saying, oh, he doesn't really want to kill a quarter of all American adult women. He just thinks they deserve to die. Yeah, exactly.
So all of that is totally incoherent, but it just made me realize, wait a minute, all of Kevin's politics emanate from him hating his birth mother and fantasizing about murdering his birth mom.
But she didn't have an abortion.
Doesn't matter to him.
No. Kevin hates his adopted parents. That is definitely true. If you read his articles about his relatives in Lubbock and how the utter hatred and contempt.
No,
he definitely hates. I think he hates his birth mother and adopted mother and all moms everywhere.
Yeah.
So he hates all parents. He's like the conservative memes about David Hogg and Antifa.
he formed his politics when he saw the Beastie Boy videos where they throw a pie in the mom's face for telling them not to party, except it's a gun. This entire Williamson thing, though, it is a great, it's sort of, that museum exhibit where they give you slices of the human body and you get to see how every little part works. This is kind of that for the conservative victimhood complex, because their whole thing for pretty much my entire life has been like, oh, your liberals are a bunch of pussies. You just come up with these new identities you can go into, slot yourselves into to make yourselves a protected class. But the moment it turns around on them, it's like, no, I'm actually an abortion survivor. And they who spent years and years and years trying to get everyone fired, the fucking Dixie Chicks, everyone.
How about just Kaepernick of a more recent vintage?
Fucking Colin Kaepernick. The second it can be turned on them, they're like, you should never go after someone's job. And I actually, like, I'm more sympathetic than most people to the, like, I'm more negative towards getting anyone fired than I think anyone in this Williamson debate. But from those fucking people who did that more than anyone, who pretty much got the ball rolling on all that shit, whenever it can be possibly turned around on them, suddenly they have every type of identifiable identity quantifier. And they are just so opposed to going after anyone's livelihood. And in the end, who gives a shit? Kevin D. Williamson is going to be invited back into the castle. Yeah.
Well,
and
he's
blah, blah, blah.
He's a literal landlord.
Yeah. Well, and also, I mean, sorry, Jeffrey Goldberg. Yeah, you fired him. But once you invite a Kevin Williamson into your magazine, he can come and go as he pleases. You better get some fucking garlic, buddy. One kind of parenthetical thing, though, that I would like someone to explain. Someone of the Connor Frycor or Brett Stevens of people.
By the way, if Molly Hemingway brought this up, is Connor Frycor, is he going to resign from the Atlantic?
He really should.
Is he going to resign? No,
Connor, resign. Connor, resign.
Yeah, be principled, buddy. But there, I need them to explain to me what are tweets. Are tweets an example of a budding hive mind of illiberal neo-Stalinists enforcing political correctness on people, or a place to blow off steam that doesn't mean anything? Which is it? Because the people who are saying they're just tweets, like Brett Stevens wrote, they're just tweets. The guy has written approximately 5 million columns about the awful tweets of the left that prove that we're headed towards gulags. So what the fuck is a tweet? Is it only a tweet when it's one of your fellow media class ghouls? And when it's the hoi polloi, it's pitchforks. Maybe that's, I guess that's the explanation.
I think, certainly similar to that, Alex Perrine made a good point about this a while ago, and he brought it up again with regards to the Williamson thing. Just like, underscoring, I sort of said it earlier, but people in the liberal media class are very invested in this idea that they are charitable and open-minded to their colleagues on the right. So much so that they invest this idea, they invest so much in this idea that it's just intellectual debate, it's just tweets. They don't actually believe the things that they claim to. Nobody could possibly believe that you could execute a woman for making a painful but personal medical decision. No, sorry, there are plenty of people who really do fucking believe that. And what's more, this whole like abortion, pro-choice, pro-life debate on the question of punishment is actually a very good one that I think we should be having, and that I think the pro-choice side needs to be asked quite point blankly, what punishment...
Pro-life.
Pro-life. Sorry, the pro-life side.
Ooh, you.
It's easy to confuse these things.
It's true. It's both.
The people who want abortion criminalized should be asked, and they should be made to answer, quite frankly, what sort of criminal punishments will be in store for not just the doctors or the women who procure them. Let's say you drive a woman to a clinic. Mm. Let's say you give her money to get an abortion. Are you an accomplice to murder as well? There's a whole litany of crimes and accomplices that can be opened up now, and I think they should be forced to delineate exactly what kind of punishment is in store for these people should Roe v. Wade be overturned and they get an abortion in a state where it becomes illegal.
Because it really does expose a fundamental problem for the anti-choice people that has been kept at bay just because it doesn't come up. Because it's all in the context of Roe versus Wade. The implications, like the actual legal implications, are sort of pushed away because it's still theoretical. But because abortion is supposed to hinge on this question of whether a fetus is a person. And it is something that is metaphysically impossible to know. All you do is you have intuitions one way or the other, and those sort of shape your politics from it. But most people, intuitively, if you told them who has more rights, a human woman who, like, you could talk to and who has a name and a personality and memories and can speak words and has like a TV or whatever,
might be a real gamer girl,
exactly, has a favorite book, you know, and a dime-sized collection of cells, people will intuitively say the woman. And that understanding is, I think, what undergirds the sort of ambient pro-choice belief that people have. But it's all kind of soft because there's no real consequences to it. It's all just sort of, I guess. But when you put it in the terms of, okay, should a woman who gets an abortion be killed or thrown in jail for years, the incongruity between the life being protected and the life being either ended or basically destroyed by prison is so vast that people are able to make that, oh, okay, now I understand, I'm pro-choice.
It should also be noted that even in a pro-Roe American society, and for, you know, much of human history, even religious institutions like the Catholic Church, for instance, regarded and terminating a pregnancy before what was known as the quickening as to be not abortion.
before they've seen Highlander 3.
Oh, well, yeah, no. The quickening meaning like when you could feel it kick. It was called like, you know, returning to menses, basically.
One of the most covertly evil associations ever in America, the AMA. We can thank them for a lot of our current abortion debate framing.
And not having health care.
They sort of push the line as terminating a pregnancy is sort of unacceptable.
Or like that it's ending a human life, equivalent to killing a baby, like infanticide.
AMA rocks, dude. Health care system is sort of like a cruel practical joke, a Rube Goldberg device, or why we frame abortion as like you were trying to kill Kevin D. Williamson. Thank you to the AMA. So also starting the myth that anyone just can't become a doctor. We could do it.
I think we're almost out of time here, but before we go, I wanted to bring up these two quotes you asked me to source from Goldberg.
Yeah, so this is a little fun. I just want one closing thought on Williamson before we go back into the Jeffrey Goldberg story. I just think what all of this proves is whether it's like the New York Times or the Atlantic or all these supposedly liberal institutions who want to challenge their liberal readership and open their ideas to critiques from outside their comfortable bubble. Forget this bullshit on the right. Write them off completely. If you really want to challenge people who are liberals, challenge them from the left. That would be useful. In a civilized liberal society, the debate should be between the liberals and the current Democratic Party and those on their left. Everyone to the right of that, they don't have ideas. They have cruelty and corruption. That's what they offer. Look who's president. Look at the movement as it actually exists, not this like fantasy parlor game that you have in your head. Write them off completely. You're not closing yourself off to like being open-minded by writing them off. It's called exercising judgment and just a bare level of morality.
Yeah, I want the pages of the Atlantic to be a sparkling debate about whether the labor aristocrats of the core capitalist countries need to be reeducated where they live or forcibly spread out throughout the rest of the world. That's the fucking debate that's worth having.
That would certainly make their readers uncomfortable. Yes. That's what they're looking to
way
do.
Way more than fucking Brett Stevens farting out another column about college students.
Seriously, though, if you want interesting people in there who actually have an audience, because I guarantee you no one is clicking on these other fucking articles, get Breonna Gray, Alex Press, Shuja Hader, Ryan Cooper. There are so many people you could hire that would write interesting things that people would actually read that would prompt the beloved parlor debate you love so much.
Matt Brunig is excellent at trolling the libs. He loves to own the libs. Let's get him on there, you know. But
you don't fucking put Jason Uhuru in there.
No, seriously,
I'm not kidding. I demand someone interesting in there.
I want Maoist third worldism to be something that these guys have to grapple with instead of something they've literally never heard of.
None of these people actually believe that like the institutions that they preside over should cater to every conceivable view.
No,
so just quit lying to yourself. And keep the right in their own little silos where they belong, their own little funny farms talking to themselves. You don't need to engage with them. They're not intellectuals. They're not good. They're not serious thinkers. They're not serious writers. Like I said, they represent cruelty and corruption, and that's it.
I mean, and the thing, talking about Williamson, people might have cost him his job, but if you want to talk about his ideas, hanging women who've had abortions is literally the only idea he's ever had. That's distinct and Williamsonian, as opposed to just bog standard conservative misanthropy, which is the rest of his fucking output.
You want to pick somebody who would actually really piss people off, but he wouldn't do it just advocating sort of a woman genocide, actually interesting, can actually write? Put Adolf Reed in there.
Ooh,
hell yeah.
He would
piss the libs off.
Oh my God. Adolf Reed can actually fucking write.
But again, it gets back to the essential dynamic at play here, which is that for committed neoconservatives like Goldberg and Bradley and the people who run the Times opinion page, what is really out of bounds is the left. What they think out of bounds is hanging bankers who are responsible for the financial disaster or for the assholes who started the Iraq war. That to them is out of bounds. Yeah. And that is why that they will always continue to play footsie with these oafish, balded, just tubs of suet like Kevin D. Williamson. Or as I call him, how about H.L. Merkin? All right, let's go back to the let's go back to the story of Jeffrey origins. So
this is a funny note. I assume you've talked about this on the show before in your in our now. What is this? The 200th
episode? This is the 200th episode, by the way. Maybe we should have done something more.
Fuck. Can we add like fireworks at the start? I don't know. Okay, you may have talked about this, but he's had an interesting post-college story. I'm reading from a post he made in The Atlantic, actually in response to Glenn Greenwald calling him for comment, clarification, asking if he took a loyalty oath when he joined the IDF. Here's the quote. As a teenager, I felt a bit like David Ben-Gurion set adrift on Long Island. I thought that Israel might have been meant to be my true home, so I moved there in my early 20s, only to learn that in Israel, I felt like George Washington. No, the rest of the paragraph does not make that make sense.
Why? Did he get some teeth pulled while he was there?
Here's the money quote. This is from
slaves?
This is from an interview that was posted on his website but taken down for some reason. I was a socialist Zionist growing up on Long Island. I lived in a non-Jewish part of Long Island, and I had the usual, or something between usual and unusual, experiences with schoolyard anti-Semitism. And those experiences sent me, in a way, to seek out some answer about my Jewishness. My parents, much to their later regret, decided to take me to Israel for my bar mitzvah. And when I was there, my eyes were open to the idea of Jewish power. I didn't put it in quite that way to myself then, but that's the way it worked. Seeing Israeli soldiers, Jewish soldiers, more to the point, Jewish tanks, Jewish machine guns, was quite exciting to a powerless 13-year-old boy suffering at the hands of Irish pogromists, juvenile pogromists.
Broke. The Irish were slaves. Woke. The Irish did the Holocaust. That is very edifying, though, because it hits at a very, very Western pathology. Politics are not the execution of power and opposing forces and the division of resources. It's personal discovery. Sorry to all the Palestinians, but I really had to find myself as a Jew growing up on Long Island.
They had cool tanks and machine guns. It was badass.
It definitely shows you that there's nothing ennobling about being abused or oppressed, because this guy got punched by some, you know, O'Doyle brother, and then he decided to go to Palestine beat the shit out of some prisoner.
The Syosset crystal knocked is nothing to laugh about, Matt.
He doesn't even say getting punched or beaten up. He just says schoolyard bullying, which just means they were probably teasing him for being a little butterball.
Yeah, the cast of an Ed Burns movie called Fat.
Here's what is so telling about that quote about, like, just being around Jewish tanks and Jewish soldiers. This little pussy had to fucking travel to a foreign country and then be ensconced in what he regarded as his own personal military state to feel any shred of self-confidence.
But not just even be safe that way. Then he had to assert himself on prisoners, on unarmed, shackled prisoners.
This is what he famously admitted to abusing.
This is Zionist eat, pray, love. But with Jeff's case, it's just eat, pray, love.
So he goes in the early 90s, he joins the IDF, he moves to Israel, and then becomes a prison guard. And here's what he says about this. It was hopelessly exotic for me. I mean, I'm from the South Shore of Long Island. And then, all of a sudden, I'm in the Negev Desert by the Egyptian border as a prison guard in what's probably the largest prison in the Middle East.
Record scratch.
Guarding the future leaders of Palestine. It was pretty exciting. Probably wondering how I got here.
Welcome to hot, dry American summer.
So, yeah, no, he felt, like I said, he was a fat kid from America, was probably a nerd, probably never got laid, probably felt inadequate, and he had to join another country's colonial military force to feel good about himself.
This is like when McLovin hung out with the cops. This is wonderful.
This is an enriching journey of self-discovery. If Jeff Goldberg had been born 40 years later, he would have been that college age woman who tried to crowdfund her second birthright trip.
Oh man, that is deep Twitter lore.
Now, it should be noted that in 2012, he tried to walk back what he wrote in his own book about being a prison guard. And he says here in an interview about it, he says, the actual title of my position was prison counselor, believe it or not, which meant I saw after.
I got to go to the big counselor's dance.
He goes,
the proper translation is prison counselor.
He goes, I saw after
you snuck across the lake to the woman's prison and woman counselors.
Yeah. He goes, I know a lot of you Palestinians think you might have a state one day, but I'm here to tell you, it just doesn't matter.
Joke's on you, critics. The actual Hebrew translation of my job title was prison virgin.
So, all of this just leading up to, of course, Jeffrey was a...
Put your hand in my pocket. Your land is mine now.
Jeffrey, of course, then went on to become a huge booster for the war in Iraq, saying in October of 2002, "In 5 years, I believe the coming invasion of Iraq will be remembered as an act of profound morality."
Nailed it.
Profound,
oh, man.
Profound reality. Morality.
Oh, yeah. You know what? Maybe that self-discovery in the prison really paid off. Very prescient lad, little Jeff.
In 2002, he also said of people saying, hey, maybe this Iraq war is unjustified and a terrible idea. He says here, "Arguments made against invading Iraq are made by people with limited experience in the Middle East. Their lack of experience...
They haven't beaten up a single Palestinian
yeah, prisoner. Their lack of experience causes them to reach the naive conclusion that an invasion of Iraq will cause America to be loathed in the Middle East rather than respected."
Great call, Jeff. All the people who made that call, who, you know, just by accident were 100% right, they never had the self-confidence that you get as a fat kid in Long Island who was bullied by the brothers McMullen and shows up and gets a toothy blowjob from a bored IDF conscript.
Hey, man, all those articles you're like for the Iraq War, that was self-care, okay? Who are you to judge?
Yeah, Jeff Goldberg should just quit The Atlantic and put a cash.me link in his bio.
So anyway, Jeffrey Goldberg exercising the same judgment in his Kevin Williamson hire as he did in his Iraq war predictions. Hard to say which one will prove out to be worse in the long run.
Well, you know, it's sad that Kevin D. Williamson saw his own shadow and Big Boy season ended.
All right, so that about does it for our retrospective on the career of Jeffrey D. Goldberg and our profile of abortion survivor, Kevin D. Williamson.
And if you've learned anything today, all the members of the show, abortion survivors, so please stop yelling at us. I actually survived an abortion and a fire.
Yeah, none of us should be alone right now.
And I have allergies.
Okay, guys.
Well, let's say something, though, about our...
Well, this is officially our 200th episode.
200 hundo epos.
Imagine that.
Long, strange trip it's been.
Like Kevin Gates says, life treats you differently when you're blessed. I'm Forrest Gump reincarnated.
Yeah, so thanks for sticking around for 200 episodes. We will be here for another 200 more. And I guess before we leave, I should...
After that, it's done. Yeah.
No. Chapo will ride forever.
Chapo forever. Wedding after wedding after wedding.
Before we leave, I should give a shout out to our guest producer sitting in today, Travis. Travis works on Last Podcast on the Left, another very excellent show, which if you're not familiar with and you're looking to pod, check it out, Last Podcast on the Left. So that's it for our 200th episode. It's me, Will Meneker, for Chapo Trap House, signing off. Bye.
Bye.